Episode 17, Season 3 of The Bad Apples. Yes, in this action-packed episode, I got lots of good stuff going on. I've got a hint from a listener, yes, a hint about how to convert OGG to MP3 from a listener, or more specifically, how to get OGG onto an iPod without Rockbox, don't worry. And I'm not really clear on what exactly that converts it to, but this listener claims that it works quite well. I will reveal the secret soon. There's also news about KDE, there's some hints about KDE. There's some X11 fun with FFmpeg, and a podcast I want to mention, and that's about it. Probably some listener feedback in there. So let's just get started. Okay, so you probably need to just jump right into the FFmpeg X11 grab tutorial, and you'll get all that information, and then you can stop listening. And, you know, I thought that might be a good way to do it. I thought I'd give the good tutorial right up front, and people can stick around for the rest, or they can jump ship. But then I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk about KDE first, because KDE is an exciting subject. It's an exciting desktop environment, and people deserve to hear about it first. So, this probably isn't news, but it's kind of news. KDE 4.2 is right around the corner. It is about, well, as of today, it's 10 days away. As of the day I will post this episode, it'll be more like 7 days away. Why is that significant? Well, 4.2 has a lot of improvements that are going to come along with it. A lot of improvements to Plasma, which is kind of everything you see on the actual desktop. It's got a lot of improvements on many of the backends, like Phonon and Strigi and things like that, Nepomuk. Things like that are being, you know, have been written quite a lot, kind of improved a lot. Some of them are just, I think, were just being implemented around 4.1.3. I certainly hadn't noticed anything with Strigi on anything previous to 4.1.3. Maybe I missed it, but that's when I remember it popping up. So there's a lot of exciting stuff happening with it for 4.2. And there's a general, you know, I mean, like I say, Plasma is being worked on a lot. So in terms of what the viewer will see, there's going to be a lot of different and kind of big improvements. The widget engine is getting a lot of attention from what I can tell. And then the dialogue boxes and things like that will pop up. Lots of attention there. One of the guys who keeps posting really, really neat, a lot of really cool sort of progressive ideas and everything, or not ideas, but he just seems to work on really cool things. That's what I'm trying to say. Is named Ivan Kukic, and he's been doing a lot of stuff. I know he's been doing. I mentioned him quite a few episodes back about when he put Plasma onto an embedded, you know, motherboard or something like that. He embedded it on some chip on some motherboard, and that was really cool. But the point is that the point about Ivan was that he's doing some really cool stuff with dialogue boxes, just, you know, making them smaller so that they don't have to take up a quarter of your space just to tell you that it's copying, you know, a file from one hard drive to another hard drive. It'll be smaller, and if you need more details, you've got a little disclosure button so that you can see more information. So stuff like that is just exciting to see being implemented. And it's not a huge deal, I guess, but it is one of those things that you're really happy to see, because now you're looking at a more polished OS. And this is what I wanted to get to, or this is one of the things I wanted to get to, is that KDE 4 honestly, when it debuted, when it first came out, if you had to use it, and I did, if you had to use it, it was totally functional. It was fine. I mean, unless your system just couldn't handle it, or you know, whoever compiled it didn't do it right, pretty much it was a usable system. I'm not saying it was always pleasant, but it was totally usable. And strangely enough, that's a really good place to start from if you think about it. Starting from, yes, it can be used, it can do what it claims to do. That's a great place to start. Everything from 4.0 up is all about implementing ideas and polishing what exists. And what's going to happen is that around 4.5-ish, I bet, it's going to be a ridiculously solid system. It's going to be unbelievable. People are going to be playing catch up with KDE. That's my prediction. Could be wrong. That's what I see. I mean, if you look at Windows 7, as everyone is saying, it's basically KDE. Like they, the Windows people must have been at that KDE 4 event, and they in Mountain View taking notes. Maybe they snuck a camera in, because everything that KDE 4 was talking about, it's just like right there on Windows 7 from the screen grabs that I've seen. And I would love to hear 330's take on this as well, because he actually downloaded the public beta of Windows 7, and I would love to hear, how just how similar it is. Although I guess he doesn't use KDE, so he probably wouldn't really know. But it's kind of shameful. And OS 10, I mean, their implementation of what we would call a file manager desktop environment is just kind of lightweight. It's just really, and I don't mean lightweight in terms of memory and footprint. I mean lightweight, like not heavyweight. It's like it just does the bare minimum. Well, okay, a little bit more than bare minimum, but it really does not give you a whole lot of flexibility or a lot of power. It gives you some nice things. It gives you some nice bells and whistles here and there. Not all of them are useful. For instance, I don't really use most of the little bells and whistles that they introduced to Leopard. And the ones that I do are ones that were introduced into Linux 5 or 10 years ago anyway. So I don't really see a desktop environment like KDE available out there. And there's this kind of weird perception, I think, in a lot of the community that KDE is too much like Windows and GNOME is more Mac-like, as if though that makes GNOME better. KDE does not, I mean, first of all, GNOME is not Mac-like, and in any way that it is Mac-like, it's probably not a good thing, because the Mac file manager and desktop environment is locked down and inflexible. So if you want to be Mac-like, do that. Which, as far as I can tell, GNOME often does. But I love GNOME. I do. I think it's great. It's a great project. It's really, really cool. However, KDE rocks. I mean, it's flexible. It's powerful. It is beautiful now. It's just everything that you could ever want in a desktop environment. It can be as complex as you want it to be, or you can simplify it. You can do whatever you want. It's flexible. And now that it's got all kinds of licensing options, I don't see why anyone would have any question about its freeness. So, yeah, KDE is the way to go. I will stop ranting now because I know you've probably heard me say that sort of thing 1,000 times before. Now, the cool thing that so that was one thought, and that is that KDE is great, and that KDE is going to take over, and that it's going to be out, 4.2 is going to be out very soon with lots of improvements. And I'm sure it'll take a little while to get into everyone's repos and all that other good stuff, but at least it'll be there. We can all try it on live CDs or whatever. Or if you're adventurous, you can compile it all yourself. No, I will not be doing that. However, one cool thing about Plasma is that there is a way to get around it eating more resources than you may have available. Plasma has a lot of transparency going on, and one of the advantages to this is that it looks neat. And, maybe there's some user-friendliness to having transparency, like being able to see through a window as to what's under it, things like that. But for older systems, obviously, that's not going to be good for you. So you can kind of knock this down in it's an environment variable, whether it's really transparent or not. The way to do this is to simply assign an environment variable as KE underscore skip underscore argb, argb underscore visuals equals 1, space plasma. You can also put this into your dot profile file. You would put export KDE underscore skip underscore argb underscore visuals equals 1. And that would make it an environment variable. That would kind of flip that switch for that environment variable. whenever you logged into your session. So that is a tip straight from Aaron Saigo's blog, which I thought was really, really handy. I might, once 4.2 does come out, once I do get it on my triple EPC, I will probably be playing around with that. So now, the obvious question I think would be how to create an environment variable in Linux. Glad you asked. It's pretty easy. There's two ways to do it. Both of them are in the terminal. The first way is to set it just for that session. And the way you would do that is you just type in some variable name with the equal sign after it, and then whatever you want that variable to be set to. So in this case, when we were saying KDE underscore skip underscore RB underscore visuals equals 1, that is creating the variable KDE underscore skip underscore RB underscore visuals, and it is setting that value to 1. Easy enough. So if you do that, it'll happen automatically. It's not going to give you any feedback. It just kind of does it. If you want something with a little bit more feedback just to see what we're doing, do this. Do PS1 equals, quote, backslash, and I do mean backslash, U, and then space backslash percent, close quotes, and press return. See what happened? Your bash prompt just changed, didn't it? Yes, now it's your username and the percent sign. Oh, mine has a backslash. I guess I didn't need to do that final backslash before the percent. Yeah, I did not have to do the backslash percent. So if you do PS1 equals, quote, backslash U space percent, quote, close quote, now you've got just your username and the percent sign as your bash prompt. Now if you close that terminal and you open a new one, look at your prompt now. It's back to normal. Okay, so we'd set a variable called PS1, which the system looks to decide what your little prompt, your shell prompt is. And since we just typed it in and didn't do anything with it, it's basically just kind of a temporary thing. It's just as long as that terminal is open, that variable is set to that value. Now, if you wanted it to stick, if you wanted it to stay that way for every session that you ever do, what you would do is put it into your home directory, into a folder, into a file called .profile. And so let's go to our home directory, and let's do a ls-a, and we'll see that there is a .profile, and now we'll do a vim.profile, or nano.profile, whatever you want. And now you've got, right now, all I've got here is just my path, which, that's not a whole lot of information. So now we can say export, I don't know, let's do ps1 equals, quote, again, backslash u backslash dollar sign, and that time you do need the backslash, I'm pretty sure, close quote, colon wq to quit, and that's all there is to it, really. From then on, every time you log in, the session, the default variable for that session will include both that path that you might have seen in the .profile file in your home directory, if there was one, and also the prompt format that you just put in there. Now, it gets a little bit complex. Like in that case, if you've got a prompt variable set in your .profile, and then you have a different one set, you know, possibly in like a .bashrc file or something like that, you might be giving conflicting information. You might have to go dig around, see what's going on there. But generally speaking, the environment variables can be set either in the terminal or in a .profile file in your home directory. And obviously you wouldn't run into any kind of conflict with such an obscure variable like KDE underscore skip underscore RB underscore visuals equals 1. Obviously that's not gonna be read in from a .bashrc file. So if you want to turn off the transparency of that, that's the variable to set either in .profile or your session. And again, that just comes straight out of Aaron Saigo's blog, so it's a pretty cool tip. Okay, so I have a listener tip of sorts. This is not verified, and it would take a lot for me to verify it, so I can't can't actually test it out, but he says, and this is, I should really probably look up who exactly told me this, just so that if it's as great as it sounds, he gets full credit for it. But anyway, this person, who I'm going to find out the name of right now, said that he's got Rhythmbox, which is not Rockbox, right? Rhythmbox is the media player for, I guess it's a GNOME app, so it's obviously for Linux. So it's called Rhythmbox, and it's pretty popular. I mean, it was one of the first ones that I'd heard about back when I was getting into Linux. I remember that was kind of like that seemed to be on everyone's tip of everyone's tongue. And I remember trying it, and I want to say that I had a good experience with it, although I don't exactly recall. I know that I was not looking for an iTunes replacement, because I didn't use iTunes, and I hated iTunes. And Rhythmbox was a little bit, you know, just like most of the GUI apps out these days, it's just a little bit too much, or the GUI music players, a little bit too much like iTunes to really be of any interest to me at all. So, but this could also obviously be a good thing. So Larry F. is his name. And Larry F. says that, well, number one, he says that he's listening to my show, which is great. Because there's that whole thing about me saying that I only had 11 listeners or something like that. So we're up to, I think I've calculated like 17 or 18 people now. But anyway, so he uses an Apple iPod, with the Apple firmware, I'm assuming. In fact, I'm sure. And Ubuntu. And so he has Rhythmbox, and I guess he was kind of concerned that I'd gone AUG at first, because he thought, well, I only use an iPod, so that's not going to work. And then Linux Cranks, this other show that I'm on sometimes, decided to go completely AUG as well. So they turned themselves into an AUG cast. And he didn't realize it. He deleted my feed because he figured, okay, well, I can't listen to the Bad Apples anymore. But he left Linux Cranks on there because they did it without any kind of warning at all. And he said that he just started, you know, he plugged it in his iPod and started to sync, you know, the podcasts over to it, however Rhythmbox does it. And he noticed that his CPU, you know, cranked up, and it kind of transferred the Linux Crank show a lot slower than usual. And he didn't think anything of it, but he was listening to the Cranks show on his iPod. And during the show, they mentioned that they'd only gone AUG. They were an AUG cast now. And so he was listening to AUG, essentially, on his iPod. But what had really happened was that Rhythmbox automatically converted the AUG to MP3 during the syncing process. Just apparently by default, because he didn't expect it. As far as he knows, he did not set anything. He didn't flip a switch to say, okay, convert AUG to MP3 or whatever it's converting it to. It just did it. So you might want to try it out if you have an iPod or if you're Peter 64 and you need an MP3 feed. Just try Rhythmbox out and see if that'll convert it automatically when it's syncing over to your device. Like I said, I haven't tried it. The only device I've got to sync is Rockbox, so that doesn't really sync the same way. It's just a mass storage device, so it wouldn't really work, I don't think. But if anyone wants to try that, you know, maybe confirm Lenny's assertion that Rhythmbox is magically converting AUG to either MP3 or AAC or whatever it's converting it to, you can certainly let me know. But it sounds pretty neat. That's a pretty cool idea. It's pretty neat. Now, I know that some of the other audio players have this capability as well. I mean, Amarok has a lot of plugins that you can use. One is called Amicode to convert. So a lot of them do this, but Rhythmbox apparently just kind of does it invisibly and automatically. So you might want to try it out if you're into that. Now, on the subject of Linux Cranks, just really quick here, they did go AUG only. To my knowledge, they're the second podcast to go AUG only. And there might have been others before, but so far, to my knowledge, we're the two AUG casts out there without an MP3 option, which, after people kind of talked to me in IRC and the emails that I'd received, I kind of got the significance of that, or the the uniqueness of it. I'm not sure how many podcasts out there are simply AUGcasts, and frankly, it's pretty neat to be one of the two shows, that did that. What surprised me initially, I guess, was that all the emails I received were really, really positive. Like everyone, literally everyone except Peter64 was really, really positive. Everyone just was like, yeah, good job, great. There were like maybe two people who mentioned to me in IRC that listening to my show now was going to have to be a two-step process for them instead of a one-step process, but it wasn't really said disparagingly. So when I found out that Linux Cranks was coincidentally going AUG only as well, I was then a little bit surprised to see in the Linux Cranks forums, which by the way is at linuxcranks.info/forum, you can sign up and start posting nonsense there if you want, or something helpful even. I was really, really surprised when I saw that that there were some people who were really, really being rude. There's just no other way to say it. I mean, really rude about them having gone AUG. And I was just, I would have expected maybe some people to say, that's a little bit inconvenient, could you please restore an MP3 feed or an AAC feed? Thanks. Okay, bye. LOL. You know, I mean, something. But people were just saying some really, really rude and mean things about having gone AUG, which on the surface really did surprise me because and I was this like, oh, wait a minute, disturbed me a little bit.
Surprised
have some interest in AUG Vorbis being
that supported format.
The people were, then I kind of thought about it. Well, okay, so some people are just dabbling with Linux. Some people might think AUG is important ideally, but the reality is that they don't have an AUG media player. Other people might just not care about AUG. You know, you don't have to care about AUG just because you use Linux, things like that. So obviously there's a lot of difference of opinions about this, and it's very arguable as well that going AUG only doesn't do anything really to support AUG. It just kind of doesn't support MP3, although, to be honest, that works for me too. And is it really making anything more than just sort of an idealistic statement? Probably not. Maybe a little bit more than an idealistic statement. The idealistic statement obviously is, okay, I'm going AUG, and that way anyone who looks at my site and my feed sees that whatever cult I'm a member of has their own solutions for everything that the other major organizations have, so that they can look at my show and see, oh, this group of people has their own codec. They have their own method of encoding music, and it's completely independent of anyone else. And I really like that. I seriously do. I really do believe that solidarity is an important thing. And if we sit around and just kind of go with the flow of the way that the major computing industry is going, which is let us own all your data, please. Let us define how you compute, how you use your computer, how you store your data, everything like that. I'm telling you, at some point,
it's going to turn ugly. You're going to be screwed. It's just like when, you know, someone is dependent upon someone else too much. You know, you hear about it all the time. Someone is just kind of letting everyone else do all the work. They're letting everyone else do all the thinking, and then that other person is gone all of a sudden. And then where's that? What happened? You know, it's the whole, you know, teach a guy to eat a fish and he fishes for life. Teach him how to catch a fish and he catches fish for life, or something like that. You know, it's that idea of getting your own footing and being independent and being self-reliant, I guess. And MP3 and all these other things that we don't ever own any code of. We never own any piece of this at all. I guarantee you at some point it's going to turn around and screw people over in a major way, because that's the business model. It's the same thing with DVDs and VHS and cassettes and CDs and all this other good stuff. It behooves these companies to screw people over in the end. And even if they're not doing it consciously, there really is no motivation for them to watch out for us. There's no motivation for them to somewhere along the line say, okay, here's the MP3 support that you need for all those old files that you've got. You know, it's just going to be one day people are going to wake up and there's not going to be MP3 support anymore. Or there's not going to be, well, there will now because the free software people have developed ways around that. But if they hadn't done that, they hadn't come up with LAME and all these decoders, you know, the MPlayer and the FFmpeg and stuff like that, then someday there's not going to be that kind of support, and people are going to be grumbling about how they have to figure out a way to convert all their stuff now because nothing will read it or whatever. So, I mean, even think about it. Even Apple, one of the most proprietary loving companies ever, they don't even really use MP3 by default. They try to avoid that. That's why they came up. That's why they opt for AAC. That's why they came up with Apple Lossless and all their little alternatives. They don't even use MP3. Someone's got to, you know, I mean, there's an issue with this. So I'm sure that was enough about MP3. So the point is that the cranks going og and these people being rude about it is just really surprising to me. And the idea that somehow by not having an MP3 feed, we're impeding upon people's freedom of choice or personal, you know, computing freedom is absurd to me. And this was said a couple of times in the forum. It's a, you know, why would you remove this option from us? It's a perfectly good feed. Why would you do that? All legalities and questions of intellectual property and all that other good stuff aside, the idea is that people who are doing ogcasts, podcasts, netcasts, and all the other things, they're doing it for free typically. They're doing it because either they want to communicate something to someone, maybe a lesson or a tutorial or something, or they just like to hear themselves talk, or all of the above. And they're not getting paid for it, invariably. So the idea that it's their obligation to provide an MP3 feed to everyone who needs the MP3 feed is, I think, a little bit presumptuous. And I realize, I'm not blind to this. I realize that a majority of the media players out there are MP3 compatible. This still does not mean that an ogcaster needs to provide an MP3 feed. It simply means that you're going to have to convert the file before you pop it onto your player. And that's not impeding freedom. It's not limiting your choice. It's simply saying, you know what? I'm not going to take the extra time and effort to encode to MP3. And I'm not going to take the time and effort to make another feed, an XML document for the other feed. Just not going to do it. I don't have the time. I don't want to be bothered with it. Whatever the reason is, that's not going to happen. And so the people who have issues with that really ought to just convert the file themselves. And they ought to stop whining about not having an MP3 feed. And frankly, it kind of offends me that people think that MP3 is so important and so vital. It's not. There are other alternatives out there. There are perfectly good codecs that are not MP3. And I think that if no one stands up to MP3, then MP3 is just going to continue to be the de facto until the MPEG decides to swap it out for something else, MPEG 5 or MPEG 3D or something like that, and then everyone else is going to be scrambling after them again. I don't like that. I don't care to do that. I don't care to hang onto the coattails of these organizations. We have our own format. We can use it. We can convert it if we have to, or we can just listen to it on our computers as an OGG, or we can install Rockbox. You know, all the different alternatives, all the different options that we've got. There are plenty. Free software has made it very, very easy for us to convert, listen, change the firmware on something, whatever you need to do. So OGG is important. I really think so. I think that we need to support it. I think we need to show the world that it's perfectly fine for us, and that if they want to play Linux, then they might want to start thinking about what a codec is, what formats are, who owns the ideas behind those codecs, and just how independent we are when we're computing. You know what else we need in the free software is an alternative to coffee. It's time for us to stop bowing down to these coffee companies and create our own beans so that we can, well, never mind, I'm only kidding. But go get a cup of coffee and enjoy it. Sip it nice and long and slow, hot coffee, delicious, and then we'll continue the episode. I love a good screencast. Admittedly, I don't watch that many because, like, I think probably most people, a lot of the podcasting and things like that I listen to are during travel when I need my eyes to actually show me where I'm going. I can't really just look at the screen. Or at work, and again, I kind of need my eyes for other tasks. But when I do watch them, I really enjoy them, because sometimes when you want to know how to do something, it boils down to being easier when you're looking at the screen. So screencasts are cool, they're important. Unfortunately, I don't think that sometimes the people who know how to do cool stuff on the computer happen to know how to capture that stuff that they're doing on the computer. There are a lot of front ends made for various screen recording tools, applications. There are a couple of different ones out there. There are sometimes just completely new ones written. There's a lot to choose from, and it seems like some of them work really well, some of them don't work that well. One of the ones that just seems to kind of keep working for me is FFmpeg. And the reason I've been thinking about this lately is because, well, number one, because I've been watching some screencasts lately, and it's been fairly apparent that they're using some kind of proprietary system in some cases to capture what their screen is doing. You know, I mean, sometimes it's just as blatant as they'll zoom out a little bit, maybe too much, and it'll show that the Linux screencast you're watching is in a virtual machine on a Macintosh using, you know, some proprietary software to actually capture the screen. Not a big deal. There's nothing wrong with it, I guess. It's just there is a way to do it on a Linux box, and it's very easy. The other reason I'm thinking about this is because I've been thinking about doing some screencasts myself just for kicks, like some screencasts about the GNU image manipulation program, possibly about like some audio editing, you know, just kind of whatever I know, just kind of get it down on a screencast, share it with people. So I've been thinking, I've been kind of playing around with screen capturing, and I've done some screencasting before for the Ubuntu project back in the day, but recently I've been looking into FFmpeg for it. And FFmpeg is a program that I've been using for a while, and the cool thing about this program is that it's so flexible and robust that you can use it for a lot of different things. It's so complex, I think,
And I don't mean complex, like hard to use. It's just got so many options that it's almost someone should write a manual for the manual. Like a recipe book or something, because you just have so many options that you have to choose from. Sometimes it does get overwhelming. So this is going to be sort of a recipe tutorial. This is how to use FFmpeg in order to grab your X session. Okay, how is it done? Yes, how is it done? First of all, you're going to want to make sure that the FFmpeg version that you have installed, or that you're going to install, supports the X11 grab function. FFmpeg doesn't release stable releases, says Fabrice Ballard and his team. They just keep working on it, I guess, and when you need the code, you dip into their SVN and get it and compile it. Or, perhaps more easily, you just go into the repo of your favorite distro and grab it from there. However, when you do that, you are subjecting yourself to whatever they compiled, whatever version and whatever preset flags and options at the compile time that they set. So, if you have it installed right now, you can just type in the terminal ffmpeg space dash v as in version, and that shows you the version, SVN R-R15261 for me, copyright blah 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 by Fabrice Ballard et al. And then it says configuration, and it shows you pretty much what they set when they were compiling it, which is actually pretty interesting. But just look through there for the X11 grab. If it says enable X11 grab, that's a good thing. That means you will be able to use this to grab your X11 session. If it does not say that, chances are, if you issue the X11 grab command with FFmpeg, that's not going. It's just going to return, that it's an unknown command. So be careful about that. Be mindful of that, and I'll tell you how to get around that if it's not enabled. I also like to just take a really quick look at what codecs and things I have available to me. So in this case, just speaking in terms of video, I've got enable libtheora, I've got enable x264, enable libxvid. That looks like it's about it. So that's important. We want to know that so that we know what we have to choose from. So having that information is good. Now, how did I get this version of FFmpeg on my Fedora 10 PowerPC computer? Well, it was not from the Fedora repository. The Fedora repository will offer a version without certain things enabled, whereas the one from RPM Fusion gives you a lot more. So whatever distribution you're using, just be mindful that their official repositories might want to respect one thing or another, while the unofficial repositories, you know, whether it's the universe or the multiverse or the unofficial versus the official or extras versus core, whatever. The main point is that you'll want to make sure that you've got the right version installed. So if you've got an old version that you're not sure about, do the ffmpeg-v, check it out. Remove it if you have to, and then reinstall from a different source. Okay, so the command that you'll want to issue, ffmpeg space dash f, as in, I forget what the f stands for, but as in ffmpeg, so ffmpeg space dash f space x11 grab space dash vc, as in video codec, space Theora, we'll just do the Theora right now, space dash s, as in size, space VGA, space dash r, as in rate, space 24, space dash b, as in bitrate, space, let's say 1000, space dash g, space, let's say 300, space dash I, space colon 0.0, space slash home slash clatu slash videos slash screen capture 1.ogv. Okay, that was a pretty long command, I know. But let's do it little by little. So ffmpeg is obviously the application we are invoking. And then you do dash f, as in Frank. I forget what the F stands for, but it means is format, like force format or something like that. So the point is that it's saying this is where you're going to get, it's almost like it's not an input, but it's almost like a source flag, so that if you wanted to get something from some other source, like, I don't know, OSS, like the sound server or something like that, you could put that in there. But in this case, we want the X11 grab. Simple enough. So you put dash F space X11 grab. And that will define that you are taking your source from your X server. Then you can do a space VC, video codec, and that will define what codec you use. The default is FFmpeg. So put nothing there, you'll be capturing an MPEG video, which could be fine, but it depends on who you're distributing it to and stuff like that. So I generally just do a Theora. So that's dash VC space Theora. You could also do XVID. That's a good free format. X264. So, and again, you can see a lot of that stuff when you just do the FFmpeg dash V for your version. It shows you what codecs are enabled. Okay, so then you do a space dash S. Now this one's tricky, and you have to really, you should just refer to the man page for this, because that's where you're going to find out a lot of these different sizes. The dash S does stand for size, and that is saying to go, you know, X many pixels across and Y many pixels down from the starting point of the most upper left-hand corner of your screen. So if you just picture a graph and you have the zero point being the upper left-hand corner, and then you go out both horizontally and vertically from there, you can figure out how many pixels you want it to capture. Now if you're trying to do a full screen kind of deal, you'll want to know what the resolution of your monitor is, and then you'll want to know what size that translates into. And I believe that there is a way, there might be a way to set the size in numbers and everything, but the way that the man page seems to prefer to do it, and the way that works best for me, or the way I've always done it, is just use the little abbreviations that they've got. So, for instance, if I'm using it on my little Fedora 10 PowerPC PowerBook G4 12-inch guy, I'm going to be doing a 1024 by 768, and it tells me that for that size, it would be XGA, is the abbreviation for that. That's the technical size of a 1024 by 768. Who knew? If I was going to be doing, maybe I only need a portion of the screen. Maybe I want to make it a little bit smaller so people can see it, download it faster and stuff. Then that would be SVGA. If I'm doing full screen on a pretty big monitor, I could do UXGA, which would be 1600 by 1200. So, yeah, those are all listed in the man page. And in terms of getting more specific, I'm not sure if you can do it with just the numbers. You might have to do something like take something larger than what you really need and then set a crop size, something like that. But typically, I mean, you don't want to go too large, because then people just aren't going to be able to download it within a reasonable amount of time. A huge element of file size for video is simply how many pixels you're trying to cram into your frame. So the next one is dash R, which is the frame rate. Some people are really conservative on frame rate, and they're like, I'm gonna cut that down to like 15 frames per second. It's not going to be very smooth. It's going to be about half as smooth as things are in real life for you. I have found that it doesn't really help that much in the larger scheme of things. I don't see any reason to jack it up to something like 2997, which would be, you know, the video frame rate. I mean, that seems a little bit excessive, but 24 or 25, depending on what your preference is, seems fine to me. I get by with that quite nicely. So that's what I always do, is dash R space 24. It's 24 frames per second. It's nice and smooth, not too taxing on the system, doesn't add too much overhead on the file size. Dash B, 1000, would be the bitrate. And if you don't understand bitrate, you need to go listen to my HPR episodes on video encoding and stuff like that, or maybe read my article in Linux Journal, whichever talks about it. I don't really remember off the top of my head. But bitrate is very important to the file size. It's also paramount to the quality of the picture. So you really need to figure out what is best for your purpose and how long your video cast is going to be versus what kind of detail needs to be seen, stuff like that. Play around with it. Get a good feel for what each bitrate does. 1,000, honestly, could be a little bit high for most purposes, but it's really something you're going to have to try out, see what you want. It's hard to say for sure what is best because I don't know what frame size you're really going to be recording and stuff like that. So figure that one out on your own. I'd start at 1,000 and kind of try to knock it down from there. Well, like I say, I mean, it really depends because if you're doing like a 16 by 1200, then you might need to keep something more like 1,000. So I don't know. Test it out, see what's best. Dash G would be standing for group of pictures, which is a way that the computer groups together pixels in order to cut down on how many pixels it needs to refresh per frame. If you have like a 24 frame rate, and you have like a 300 GOP size, 300 divided by 24 is roughly 12.5. So every 12.5 seconds or so, there are going to be what are called intraframes. That's pretty reasonable. You could make that more frequent if you want, but for most screencasting, I don't think that would be necessary. Now, if you're doing something weird, like if you're playing something on some online video site, and you're using screen record to rip that video, then you would want to make that more frequent, because otherwise you're not going to get very good, you're not going to get a really, really high quality video. But if you are just doing a screen record because you want to show someone how to do something in GIMP, I don't think you're going to need anything higher than that. The next one is dash I for your input, and in this case, since the format is the X11 grab, the input is going to be :0.0, meaning your main display or your main screen, whatever. If you're doing the whole two monitor setup thing and you want to record, you know, off of a different physical monitor, then what would it be? It would be like :0.1, I think, or 1.0, I forget. I think it's 0.1 because it's on the same, it's on that screen, but it's on the second monitor or display. So best of luck figuring that out. I don't do a whole lot with two monitors right now. Hard for me to really be authoritative about that. And then the last thing that you put without any switch at all is simply the output file. And just put it in your videos folder. So I just do the /videos, or if you have movies or, you know, whatever thing to denote that you have moving images, /screencapture.ogv, OGV being the suffix for OGG video. So that's it. It'll start recording. It'll start dumping whatever's happening on your screen to this file, and away you go. Just start recording whatever you need to record. And that's really about it. There are a lot of other options. You can't imagine how many options you've got. For instance, if you don't want to, let's say you're using KDE, but you have the kicker up at the top, as if though it was almost like a GNOME panel up at the top. Or maybe you have a kicker at the top and the bottom, and you don't want to record the kicker. You just want the main screen. Well, what you'd have to do, or what you could do with FFmpeg's sheer power and flexibility, is to go to, or rather define the offset for where it starts. And then you can say, okay, the offset is going to be so many pixels down by so many pixels across, you know, to the right. And then it won't record certain areas of the screen. You can do an offset with time as well. So if you know that you are going to need a little bit of time to get set up and everything, then you can give yourself an IT offset and put in the hours, minutes, and seconds of how many seconds you need to have to set things up before it actually starts recording, and then it will start recording after a while. You can set a title, set comments, authors, copyrights, albums, track, everything you can imagine. You can, let me think, what else can you do? That's about it. I mean, just look through the man page and you'll see. I mean, honestly, the command that I just gave you is the one that I use mostly, just kind of keeping it simple and easy. There's rarely a time that I have to do a whole lot more than that. But it's definitely a good little program. It's got a lot of different commands that you can use. There's just a lot you can do with FFmpeg. For more on FFmpeg fun, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio's Ken Fallon did an episode on capturing video, and he did an episode where I think he even made a shell script on how on a more efficient way to use FFmpeg to grab video from his camera, for instance. So you've got a lot of FFmpeg is used a lot of places. So get to know it, get to love it, get to use it, and have fun. Okay, almost finished here. Looks like what we've got is some listener feedback, and there's actually quite a bit of listener feedback, but I've got a whole episode of just listener feedback coming up, episode, I think 16, and I know, this is episode 17, I'm doing it out of order. Episode 16 will be listener feedback as well, but I wanted to hit some more recent ones just now. So, Red, apparently his name is Red Intray. I don't believe that's his real name. Maybe it is. Maybe I just gave away his real name, and maybe he's gonna get in trouble for listening to this show. That would be a bummer. But Red is saying that he enjoys the show, and that he does listen to the show, which is always good to hear. Everyone is trying to claim their number, you know, their little number on my big list. And I think by the end of episode 16, I think we're up to like 17 listeners. So Red is probably sort of like number 18 or so. But he says, let him know his all-important reference number. Sounds very Orwellian. And I will take that, Orwell, and raise you Brazil, and I will give you the reference number 18A00TAC-B. That is your reference number, Red. Thank you for writing in. Thank you for listening. Let's see who else wrote who actually listens to the show. You know who I got was this guy here, Barry. He's a little bit late in coming to my rescue about the Gmail thing. He's saying he told me a couple of ways to get, you know, email out of Gmail, and I told him that the concern is actually for my chat logs, that people keep chatting me via Gmail, not just friendly chats. I'm talking about like the projects that I'm working in. So I told him about that. I also got some mail over at Linux Cranks, and again, I'm just going to claim all that as my own, because the way I see it is that the Cranks don't ever read their feedback, and they never let me read my feedback, or if they do, they don't respond to it very well. So I'm going to just take it for my show. And let's see what we got here. Just logging in to my application. Any day now. Okay, so very recently I got an email from Peter64, who says that EarOS, which I discussed in episode 15 very briefly, just as kind of I was highlighting the fact that GOS was such a nice operating system, a nice looking operating system, good for noobs. And I mentioned briefly that Peter64 had actually put EarOS on a friend's computer. Peter64 said that it didn't go over all that well. I mean, it went over well, but the performance of that particular distro as a desktop environment wasn't necessarily the best, I think. I mean, I really think that it was kind of a specialized distribution. They needed it as a media center front end, basically, or I guess a GUI front end for their media functionality, and I don't think it's sounding like they didn't really necessarily mean for it to be an everyday desktop, even though it's got the GNOME desktop right there. It doesn't sound like it worked that well with that. So possibly GOS, still a good-looking one for all those noobs out there. Bill wrote in, says, again, add me to your list. He says he's number 12 because I think I'd left off at some point at number 11, but in fact, it's much more, he's probably like number 19 at this point. But he makes a claim to have been listening to the Bad Apples since episode number 1, which I have to say, that's a pretty big claim. He says since number 1. I'm assuming that means episode 1. I just think that, I mean, that's, I know of one person who's been doing that, and that's Digzit. And, he was the only one. So if Bill is laying claim to being a listener since then, he's gonna have to come through with some proof or something, because that's a serious, serious claim. And if Digzit ever found out, I think that might cause some problems. But, other than that, I think I cover all the other ones in episode 16, or no, yeah, 16 is the one that I'm going to just catch up on all the listener feedback in. And I'm doing it out of order because I wanted to get the KDE tip and stuff like that out first, you know, because that's kind of time sensitive. Oh yeah, you know what, I don't think I read this one in episode 16, so I should mention it really quick. Buddy writes in, and I'm not calling him my buddy. His name is Buddy. Although I'll consider him my buddy. So my pal Buddy wrote in and said that he was going to install Fedora 10 on a PowerBook G4, and he was kind of curious if I had anything to say about it. And you know, I do, Buddy. I have something to say about that. I've installed Fedora on, well, Fedora 10 specifically on one machine, and one of them is the one that I'm recording this one on right now, and one of them is the computer sitting next to it, the 12-inch PowerBook G4, and it runs really well. I don't really... I use it mainly as it's just kind of an extra computer that I have sitting here just kind of for reference during the show. I leave it open to IRC a lot. It's just kind of a, you know, it was a spare computer, so I threw Fedora 10 on it just to see what would happen. I actually had Yellow Dog on it at first, but the repository situation with Yellow Dog is just not that great, so I chose to go to Fedora 10, and it's been running really well. I have no complaints. The repositories are pretty full. Between the official and the RPM Fusion stuff, there's not really anything that I've been looking for that I haven't been able to find for PowerPC, Linux, Fedora. That's not true. You know, Synfig, the animation program, I didn't see that anywhere in the repositories. I think I would have to probably... like compile that myself or something, but yeah, I mean it's working pretty well. I don't have a Wi-Fi card in this computer, so it didn't pick that up. And I think if I had, it wouldn't have picked it up anyway because this time period would have been the Broadcom stuff. So I doubt that would be picked up automatically. But I understand that there is a free Broadcom firmware now, so I could not from Broadcom obviously, but so I could use that, or I could do a firmware cutter if I had to. It doesn't really matter. For more information on Fedora on PowerPC, you might want to listen to the very beginning of episode of season 2, which I believe, if I recall correctly, I do a fairly lengthy episode on installing Fedora on an iBook G4. So it would practically be the same. The sound system on this computer really gave me a horrible time. I had to figure out what module needed to be loaded, and I had to make some modifications. Unfortunately, I don't really remember exactly what I did at right now. I thought, in an email to him, I thought it had been something called Alpha Config, but that turns out to have been what I used on a Debian system for PowerPC. And that worked really nicely, but I can't find an Alpha Config on this Fedora system, so I must have done something different. I must have done there's a module that I can't remember right now for PowerPC Sound, and you can get it working fine. You just have to find out what that module is and make sure that it's loaded and stuff like that. Why Fedora doesn't automatically detect that, I don't know. I mean, I just don't know enough about auto-detecting and kernels and installing, you know, to really know anything about it. So, but, I mean, in terms of performance, the machine's great. It runs really well. But like I say, all I'm doing on it is stuff like terminal applications and IRC and just kind of things like that, just kind of playing around on it, not giving it a run for its money or anything. But overall, I will say that the PowerPC Fedora performance has been really great on the other machines that I've installed it on. I love it. I really do. It's very comfortable to me. I get along with it quite well. Having said that, I get along quite well with the Debian installs and the Slackintosh installs as well. And honestly, to this day, the Slackintosh install that I did on my iBook G4 was the best PowerPC install I've ever done. It knew everything. It detected, I mean, aside from the Broadcom, for that you still have to do the firmware switch. But in terms of like the sound system and everything like that, it was one of the smoothest ones that I've ever done. The mouse button is always going to be an issue with Macintoshes until someone realizes that a PowerPC distribution, you know, if it's going to be destined for a PowerBook or an iBook or MacBook or whatever, it needs to have some functionality to make a right click out of one button. You know, whether it's holding down the control key and clicking, that's the preferred method, I would think, because if you're a Mac user, that's what you're used to anyway. But even just giving this, you know, an F12 or an F11, the functionality of a right click, that would be better than nothing. But a lot of these distributions just don't quite have that finessed, and you have to go in there and modify your zorg.conf or your HAL and try to make it work, and that seems to be not very fun. In fact, I have not configured that on this PowerBook, I think. Let me check. Hold on. You see how often I use it. Come on. You see? Yeah, correct. I do not have it configured on this PowerBook G4, so that would be something to look into. That's about all the listener feedback I've got. If you need to reach me, you know all the addresses, I'm sure. It's Klaatu at linuxcranks.info, Klaatu at hackerpublicradio.com. Those are the two best emails these days. That brings us to the end of episode 17 of season 3. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate it. Glad you're enjoying the show. Hope you're enjoying the show. I should probably tell you, I should warn you up front, that next season, that is season 4, we will be going to an all-flash format. I'll be doing video casts only on YouTube of about my favorite coffees. And of course, yeah, I'm just kidding. season 4 is just around the corner. It'll be AUG only still, and there's not really anything to say about that. If you need to reach me, I just told you the email addresses. If you want to see the website, it's thebadapples.info. That is thebadapples.info. And be sure to check out Hacker Public Radio, a really great show done by the BinRev people. It's every day a new episode by a new person, or by a different person, on all kinds of cool, geeky, techie, hackery things. So check it out. HackerPublicRadio.com. See you around. See you next time.
during my service in the United States Congress, I took the initiative in creating the Internet.